Okay. So our topic this morning and next week as well will be Purim. And that's relatively easy for me to do this year because I've been doing Megillat Esther as a topic all year. So I gave you at the top of the source sheet a link where you could find the other classes on the Megillah for those who are looking for more. What I thought I would do, since we're doing just 2 weeks, is focus on two stories in the Megillah. The first one for this week, the showdown between Achashverosh and Vashti, and the roots of a surprising medrash about Vashti. And then next week, why do we care so much about Haman's lottery? So Haman chose the date when he's going to attack the Jews based on a lottery. Therefore, we end up naming the holiday for it. Like, you know, when you think about, let's say, Pesach, right? Pivotal moment. Hashem spares us during Makas Bechoros and takes us out of Egypt. That's Pesach. Or really, that's really the day, that's really the 14th day of Nisan. That's Pesach is not the holiday. The holiday is Chag HaMatzot. It's the holiday of the Matzah, which again, that's a major point for the Yom Tov. Purim, what does our celebration have to do with Haman's lottery? So that'll be, God willing, next week. But let's talk Vashti. We know the basic story, I hope. Vashti refuses to go to the party. Achashverosh doesn't really take it very well. Throws a tantrum, calls his advisors, and in the end, she is either deposed and executed. And a decree goes out to the entire kingdom that women must do what their husbands tell them to do, which no doubt was very effective throughout the Persian Empire. So, I'm missing a lot of details in this story. There's a lot that I don't understand about this story, just on a very basic level. Things like, why does Achashverosh take what should have been a domestic issue between himself and his wife and turn it into news for his entire empire, right? I mean, you didn't help yourself by doing that. Or another question, why does he call what seems to be his political advisors to have a conversation about what Vashti refused, his request? So those are sort of just like basic, I don't get it type things. But there are other questions to be asked. What questions would you ask about that story? Or did I take the two best ones?
Maybe the extreme reaction, and then the immediate replacement of the wife.
Yeah, like why such a harsh reaction? I mean, it's incredibly harsh. He doesn't actually replace her immediately. It's unclear what the time lapse is between when Achashverosh gets rid of Vashti and when they do this competition for the new wife. Because in the next, you know that the party takes place in his third year, right? The Megillah says so. And you know that Esther is selected Bishnat Sheva in the seventh year. So there is as much as 4 years in between. The only question is, does that mean it took him 4 years of doing this competition? Or does that mean that they only actually suggested it 4 years later? Unclear. Can't tell. I have another question to ask here. Presumably you all learned the medrash that the Gemara brings regarding what it was that Achashverosh actually demanded of Vashti. Right? The Megillah says, Laharot ha'amim v'hasarim et yofya, to demonstrate her beauty to all the nations and to all of the nobles who are at his party. And you're familiar with the Gemara that says that it's not only that, but that she should actually be there without clothing. That's the Medrash. Did you ever stop and think about just how strange that request is? Even leaving aside the Gemara, leaving that aside, just the idea that he's bringing her out to be on display, I don't really get why that would help Achashverosh. What is that? What it's all well and good to say he's an insecure guy and he needs to feel good about himself and he wants their praise for the beauty of his wife. But really, when you think about it, we usually think of a queen, honestly, in the ancient world as more or less the king's personal property. And I'm going to bring illustrations for that from Tanakh a little bit later. Putting her on display for the kingdom is counterintuitive, to say the least. And it also leads to the big question of, and this is how I titled the shiur, is Vashti a villain or a victim? This is a question that a lot of feminists are actually asking these days. If you Google Vashti, you'll find all sorts of very interesting articles where they're trying to sort of redeem Vashti as a feminist hero for say, Ahasuerus. And she's sort of a martyr for the cause. On the other hand, when we learn about her as kids in school, right, she's a villain. That's the way that she's portrayed. So I want to see what we can get out of all these questions in terms of understanding what's going on at the story. So I'm going to start with the party itself that Ahasuerus holds. And remember that Ahasuerus holds two parties, right? Who is invited to his first party? Who was invited to the first party? Anybody remember?
Wasn't it the entire city? The entire
town? So, nope, not an entire anything in the first party. Sorry? Someone else was going to say? So, Bishnat Shalosh Lemolcho, the third year of his reign, okay? This is the very beginning of the Megillah. Asam Ishteh L'chol Sarav V'Avadav Chel Paras Umadai Hapartimim V'Sarei HaMedinot L'Fanav. He makes a party in the third year of his reign for all of his servants, meaning all of the nobles of all of the lands in his empire. It is a six-month party for all the leadership of 127 lands. That's why it needs to be a six-month party, because you can't just expect them all to show up at once, right? They'll all make it whenever they make it. And also, it's probably not a good idea for all of the kingdoms under his reign to be without their administration for, you know, some period of time. So maybe they stagger it. Maybe they have a Google Doc and there's like a sign up and, you know, I'll show up on this day and I'll bring this. I don't know exactly how they work that out, what the coordination and logistics department in Ahasuerus' palace look like. But it's a 6-month party for all of the leaders from all the different lands, followed by a 1-week party, which is for the people of Shushan, all the residents of Shushan. And that's where the Gemara has its classic question of whether Ahasuerus is smart or foolish. The Gemara understands that Ahasuerus was trying a strategy, that he wants to take care of everybody, and that either he should have really invited the people of Shushan first, right, to play to his base. That should have been what he did first, and then afterwards invite everybody else. Or he was really smart. He took care of everybody else, trusting that his base would wait to be invited later. Hey, guys. Welcome. So you could read it either way. You could read Ahasuerus as smart, you could read Ahasuerus as foolish, but that's what happens in the Megillah. So here's my opening question. What's the goal of these parties? What is Ahasuerus trying to obtain by inviting first all the nobles and then inviting all the people of Shushan to his palace in the third year of his reign? What's he trying to do? Is it just, you know, never miss an opportunity to get drunk? I mean, that is consistent with Ahasuerus, right? Esther knows how to get to Ahasuerus, just invite him to a party. Like, but why this?
So is it popularity so that he could continue to reign over more vast lands and other nations?
So popularity is certainly a theme for Ahasuerus in general. Ahasuerus is concerned that that people perceive him in a certain way, and he's very focused on that. That's clear, you know, in his decree about Vashti, obviously. And I think there's something to be said for that. So some take it not necessarily about popularity in terms of winning friends, but in terms of impressing them. He wants to impress everybody. And that's the approach, let's say, that that Malbim, among others, takes. That he wants to demonstrate all of his power and all of his status. And here I point you to something in the second pasuk in the Megillah. Do you have a Megillat Esther there? I don't think I mentioned in the email that it would be a good idea to have one. And the truth is, you can follow the Shir without it, but you're better off if you have it. I suppose, since I'm, you know, operating off the computer anyway, I could just open it up on here. So maybe I'll do that. Okay, so I'm going to share screen with it for a limited time, because I really don't like sharing screen, because then I can't see the people I'm talking to. That's no fun. Okay, so you should be able to see at this point the first perek of Megillat Esther. So we're told in the second pasuk, Bayamim Haheim, in those days, Kesheves HaMelech Achashverosh Al Kisei Malchuso, when King Achashverosh is sitting on his throne, Asher B'Shushan Habira, which is in Shushan. Shushan was the winter capital of the Persian Empire. Bishnas Shalosh L'Malcha, in the third year of his reign, Asa Mishteh L'Chol Sarav V'Avadav, he made a party for all of his officers and so on, what I just told you before. But there's an interesting twist. If you followed the language carefully, in Pasuk Gimel, it says what I told you before, that this is the third year of his reign. But what did it say in Pasuk Bet? When is it according to Pasuk Bet? It's when he's sitting on his throne. Why wasn't he sitting on his throne in year one?
Is that new palace?
New palace. Could be. Or new throne. Take a look at source number one on your sheet, the Medrash in Esther Rabbah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bishnat Shalosh Lemelechet HaKisei, the third year of work on the throne. You ever have that, where you hire somebody to do a job and to make something and it's just dragging? So, 3 year process to build this throne. Came and Shigamar Melechet HaKisei, they finished making the throne. Ah, now I'm going to have a party. He had ordered a new throne. There's a whole lot more in the Medrash about it. The throne is modeled on Shlomo's throne. That's a very interesting idea. Take a look now at source number two, what Malbim does with this. Malbim says, kings don't want new thrones. Kings normally like old thrones. Take a look at source number two. Atamisaper. Now it tells us, you know, I'll just read my English translation because there's a lot of text. Now it reports how immediately, at the start of his reign, he grabbed hold to such an extent that his heart led him to alter the throne which had been in Babylon, moving it to Shushan, and making Shushan the capital and royal city, meaning, remember that his ancestor Cyrus had defeated the Babylonians. He took that throne that had been there. He moves it to Shushan, makes Shushan his capital, and then, as it continues, thus he showed, one, his strength, thinking immediately to reign without limits, and to such an extent that he did not fear that his subjects would rebel against him for changing the royal throne. He says, I can do what I want. And two, his greatness and power. For when a regular person becomes king, it is his honor to sit on the throne of past kings, not on a throne he makes for himself, which would actually reduce his honor. It's better to have an heirloom throne. But he exalted himself so much that he established a new throne for himself. He wants to demonstrate power. I can do what I want. And he wants to show, I am independent. People will honor me for me. And it adds that he did not demonstrate this power after holding the throne for a long time, but immediately in those days. So this is an approach which suggests that the party is about saying to the world, I can do whatever I want. I moved my capital. I built a new throne. I don't need to rely on anybody else. I am an independent man. That's one way to look at what he's doing, the message he's trying to send with this party. There's a lot more to this. If you go to that link where I gave you the link at the top to other Shiurim on Esther, I developed the idea more in the series on the Sefer. There's a second approach, which suggests that this is actually about us. It's a celebration of the defeat of the Jews and a function of our exile. Remember, Megillat Esther in general is unlike almost everything else in Tanakh in that it is a book about Galut, right? It's a book about Jews living in exile. What other Sefer in Tanakh is about the Jews living outside of our land? Daniel, right? Except that much of Daniel is focused on prophecies of how we're getting back to our land. Right? The whole second half of the book. But you're right.
We never got to that in our shir, so.
Sorry?
We never got to that in our Daniel.
No,
shir.
It's true. We stopped. More's the pity. But yes, Daniel, Yechezkel, but also Yechezkel's visions are all about what's going to happen in coming back to the land. Right? He has his exile section, but he has his prophecies of the rebuilding and so on. It's rare in Tanakh to see Jews living outside of the land, because we don't belong here. So the point here is that this book sets up a party here, which is a celebration of that exile. And so you get a Gemara in Megillah in source number 3, which talks about how Ahasuerus creates the party to celebrate specifically the demise of the Jews. And the reason it's in year 3 is because he makes a calculation that at this point, the Jews have undergone 70 years of exile. There was a prediction from the Navi Yirmiyahu that after 70 years, we would return to our land. He thinks the 70 years have expired, and he's going to make a party. I'm not going into the whole Gemara here in source number 3, because that's going to take us into a lot of math, and I'm not so interested in the math this morning. But basically, Belshazzar, who was the last king of the Babylonian Empire, the one who was defeated by Koresh, by Cyrus, so Belshazzar makes a party, which is also considered to be a party celebrating the demise of the Jews, which is why if you were to learn Daniel, the 5th parak, where they talk about Belshazzar's party, he brings out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash. He's celebrating that the Jews are now defeated. He has one calculation of the 70 years. And then Ahasuerus says, I have a different calculation of the 70 years. It's a long story. Not so necessary for us right now. The point is simply it's a second explanation of why he makes this party. It's not about an obsession with power and independence and status. Rather, it's a celebration of Jewish defeat. That's the second approach. And then the third approach is actually that the party is Hashem's feast. It's not Ahasuerus' feast at all. It's God's feast. And it's Hashem's story. And I base that on this very funny medrash in source number 4. When Ahasuerus is introduced in the Megillah, it was in the days of Ahasuerus, who Ahasuerus? He is Ahasuerus who reigned over and so on. And you read it and you have to wonder, why did you need to say who Ahasuerus? Just say, Vahi b'me Ahasuerus, Hamolech, and so on. Why did you need to say, and it was in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus who reigned? So the medrash in source number 4 describes how Ahasuerus changes in the course of the Megillah, and this medrash may be read as Hashem changes Ahasuerus in the course of the Megillah. So take a look at source number 4, and I'm going to go again with my English translation for you. You can see the original Hebrew there as well, but Rabbi Yehuda said Ahasuerus in the first place, who killed his wife for his friend. And then Hu Ahasuerus Shaharag Ohavo Mipnei Ishto, he killed his friend because of his wife. Meaning, he killed Vashti on the advice of his advisor, and then he kills his advisor, Haman, because of what Esther says. And then Rabbi Nechemya says, he was Achashverosh who halted construction of the Beis HaMikdash. That's a discussion in Ezra chapter 4. But he's also Achashverosh who decreed that it should be rebuilt. Also, a little bit more of a discussion than we have time for right now. Rabbi Yitzchak says, it's Achashverosh in whose day all of the troubles came, but it's also Achashverosh in whose day all of the good things happened. And so on. The point of this medrash is that we're saying Achashverosh is one person in the beginning, and then he becomes somebody else later on, and it's through Hashem that these things happen. Hashem is the one manipulating things every step of the way. Well, that's the party. That gives us a little bit of context for what happens for Vashti. So now let's move into the story with Vashti. And I'm going to share again Megillat Esther on the screen. If you have your own, it's Psukim Tet to Yud Bet, 9 to 12. Gam Vashti Amalka Asta Mishtei Nashim. Vashti also made, Queen Vashti also made, a party for women. Beit HaMalchut Asher LaMelech Achashverosh. In the royal palace of King Achashverosh. Bayom HaShivii, it's day 7. Ketov lev hamelech bayayin. His heart's pretty good with wine. King's feeling good, meaning intoxicated. It's already day 7, you know. Amar limuhuman bizesach arvona bigsav avagsaz esar v'charkas. He summons 7 agents of his. Shivat ha-sarisim. The 7 sarisim. Sarisim are officers. It may mean eunuchs. Different possibilities. Hamasharsim es pnei hamelech Achashverosh, who serve Achashverosh. By the way, did you notice the third name on the list? Charvona. Right? The one who shows up at the end at the end of chapter 7 to report on Haman and the plot against Mordechai. So he's already here in Perek Aleph. People miss that. Lahavi es vashti amalka lifnei hamelech becheser malchus. So he says to them, bring Vashti, the queen, before the king, in the royal throne, in the royal crown, to display her beauty for everybody, because she's really pretty. And Vashti refuses to show up. Queen Vashti says, I ain't showing up because the king orders me to. Asher biyad ha-sarisim, this order that was sent via the king's agents. Vayiktov ha-melech me'od v'chamaso bo'arovo. And the king is very angry. Those are the psukim. So there's a lot to say about this refusal and this story, but I want to highlight a medrash. So I'm going to stop sharing the screen, and I'll point you to source number 5, the Gemara in Megillah. The Gemara asks why Achashverosh is so angry, and look at the answer. Vayiktzov hamelech ma'od. King was enraged. Amai dalka bekulei hai. What made him so upset? So she said no. Okay, fine, laugh it off. What's he so angry about? So Amar Rava. Rava says, shalchalei. She sent a message to him. Bar ahorire de Abba. My father's stable boy. Abba lekavel alfa chamrashasi velaravi. My father drank opposite 1,000 men, and he didn't get drunk. And that's in the party, what she's saying is her father is Belshazzar. Belshazzar, that last Babylonian king, when he makes his party in the 5th parak of Daniel, it says he drank opposite 1,000 men. So she says, my father could hold his alcohol. He drank, didn't faze him. Vahu gavra ishtiti b'chamre. And that guy, meaning you, you've become a fool with your wine, summoning me out here to your party. So at that point, v'chamaso baravo. At that point, he is livid. He's furious that she's mocking him in this way. So the point that I wanted to draw from this, and you've probably heard this before, is the idea that Vashti is the true power in this family. You've heard that before? Okay. So it's the idea that, and it's the Gemara, that Vashti's father was the last Babylonian king, and that Ahasuerus marries Vashti to gain aristocratic status, even though it's now the Persian Empire, it's no longer the Babylonian Empire. But by marrying Vashti, he gained status. He had been a stable boy. It's sort of the reverse of all the Disney movies, right, and all the fairy tales. But that's the idea. He gains royal status by marrying her. So much so that if you take a look at source number 6, the Medrash in Esther Rabbah, Arba Nashim Natlu Memshala Ba'olam, there were 4 women who took the reins of power in the world. Ve'elohein, and here they are, Izebel, right? Izebel, wife of Ahab, we'll talk about her in a little bit. Atalia, as well. Atalia is a tremendous story in her own right. She basically killed out the royal family. Her son was killed, and so she killed everybody else, and took the throne. Those are the 2 Jewish, women, although whether Izebel is Jewish remains to be seen. As well as a woman named Semiramit, that's her own story, and Vashti, from the nations of the world. So Vashti is the woman who really is the power in this couple. That's the Medrash. Vashti is the royal power. Ahasuerus is a guy who just, you know, married into it. So what I want to know is, how did they come up with this? Where in the text do I get any hint that Vashti is, in fact, the power in this relationship? What would you say?
Well, it says in the pasuk, "Gam v'shtiyam asa mishen nashim beit hamalchut."
Yeah.
So wouldn't that point to?
Well, that just says that she also made a party in the palace. I mean, where else should the queen make a party?
Right. So wouldn't it be? Like, why mention it?
Interesting. So there are midrashim that pick up on Goldie's point, although they take it in different directions, some of them. So one of them suggests that she actually did this as a hostage strategy. She, instead of making her party in Beit Hanashim, which is an area where the women were that we meet later in the Megillah, she specifically does it in Beit HaMalchut so that she can hold the wives hostage in case the husbands try anything against Ahasuerus. That's one approach. There are other approaches that are brought in the Medrash. So you're right for picking up on that. So does that mean then, is that a seed for the idea that she is the royal because otherwise how does she get to do it in the Beit HaMalchut? Maybe. What else do we see?
It says in later on, they switch from Vashti Hamalka to Hamalka Vashti.
Yeah.
Right? The wording says, so like, the queen Vashti.
Right. So and I've seen attempts, both with Vashti and with Esther, to note where it says queen, where it doesn't, where it puts queen before the name or name before the queen, but I've never been able to make it work consistently across the Megillah. Like, there are particular places where it, where it says it, and you look at it and think, oh, maybe this is trying to tell me something, but it's hard to apply that consistently across the Megillah. So I think part of this, Yael, you were going to say? I think part of this, is Ahasuerus, part of it is the question I asked before about the odd request that Ahasuerus made. Meaning, the king usually views the queen, I said this before, as his personal property. Right? I'll give you an example. When Absalom rebels against David, right, against his father, so his advisor, Achitophel, tells Absalom that to demonstrate that he is serious, he should take David's concubines before the nation, in order to demonstrate that he is now the king. No one else has access to the women who are associated with the king. so that the argument may be made that that you know she's not supposed to be on display in front of everybody else, and so maybe we're meant to understand that putting her on display is because he's trying to take her down a peg. He's trying to say, I can make you do what I want to degrade this person who is the real power in the family. So that may be one idea. Also, it would explain why she thinks she can say no to Ahasuerus. Right? If she is just somebody who married the king, and the king orders you and says, you're going to the party, then you know that saying no is a death sentence. However, she thinks she can get away with it because she is the true royal in the family. So that's that you could suggest it's answering questions. Questions like what Goldie pointed out from the text, questions like some of the logical questions that I just asked. I think you could work with those. But I think there's another way to see this. Because I think there are other ways you could answer those questions. You didn't need to say that Vashti was the true power in order to explain why Ahasuerus did this. If Ahasuerus' whole party is about showing off, so maybe also bringing her out is also about showing off. But I think that there's another idea here. There's an idea going on in this. And in order to grasp what it is, we need to understand how Medrash works. There are different kinds of Midrashim. There are Midrashim which are not really Medrash at all, so to speak, but are just messages. Medrash at its core, Dalet Resh Shin, is to analyze language in Psukim in order to draw a message. If it doesn't have an analysis of a text, it's not really Medrash in the technical sense. It's just a message. And that's one kind of Medrash. Then you have Midrashim, which take a Pasuk and then have a tradition about how to read the Pasuk. It's not so much about an analysis as it is, I have a tradition. But sometimes Medrash is deductive, where the sages look at a Pasuk and they figure something out and then use it to explain details in a story. So I gave you a source on this, source number 7. I'm going to skip it in retrospect. I think I don't need to go through it, but it's a source from Yeshaya Detrani, writing about Medrash back in, 800 years ago, and talking about Medrash as deductive. The idea that Chazal can look at a Pasuk and analyze its meaning in a lot of different ways. So I think what's going on here is that third kind. I think what's going on here is a deduction. They look at Vashti's imperiousness, the fact that she can, say what she wants to Ahasuerus, and they look at her fearlessness, and they see a model which is found elsewhere in Tanakh. The daughter of royalty who holds that over her husband. I think it's not new to Vashti. I think it's seen elsewhere. It's a biblical archetype. And now I refer you back to source number 6. With the four women who reigned over the world, right? Well, Semiramit is a bit of a sifer. We don't have good information on who Semiramit was. However, we do know who Izebel was. And we do know who Ataliah was. And surprise, surprise, in both cases, they are independently royal women. So I gave you references in source number 8, and if you have a Tanakh, you can use it to look them up, but I am going to share a screen so that you could all see it in case you don't have a Tanakh with you. But we're looking first at Malachim Aleph, Perek Chaf Aleph. So, can everyone see that? Do you need me to increase the font size or you're good? I don't know what a head shake no means. Does that mean no, I don't need to increase the font size? Okay, we're good. Thank you. So, if you look at Pasuk Chaf Hei here, okay, chapter 21, sentence 25, this is Izebel we're talking about now. So, Izebel is actually the daughter of the king of Sidon. She marries Ahav, who's the king of the northern kingdom of Yisrael. But Tanakh credits her as the true power in that relationship. So take a look at this pasuk here, Chaf Hei, that I'm pointing you to. Rak lo haya ka'achav. There was no one like Ahav, asher hismaker la'asos hara be'enei Hashem, who sold himself to do that which was bad in the eyes of God. Asher hesata oso Izebel ishto. Who was the one who got him to do those bad things? It was Izebel. She is the one who got him to do the things he did. And the best example of it is the story that appears earlier in that perek, in that chapter, Melachim Aleph Chaf Aleph, the execution of Navos, in order that Ahav should be able to get his vineyard. That is all done by manipulation by Izebel. It's a whole story in its own right, good for us to discuss another time. But Izebel is the one who drives that monarchy, and I'm going to show you as well. In Melachim Bet Perek Yud, they talk about Izebel as, here's the last word in that sentence, Hagivira. She was known as Hagivira. What does Givira mean?
Strong one.
The strong one, right? Givira is the female of the word?
Gibor.
Gibor.
Or
Gevir. Or Gevir. Either way. It's not the word Malka. You know? It means the one with the power. That's who Izebel is. Izebel, now Ahav is also royal. However, Izebel, coming into this as the daughter of the king of the Tzidonim, brings her own royalty into it and dominates the relationship. Well, Ahav and Izebel had a daughter, and their daughter's name was Atalia. And here I show you in Melachim Bet, Perek Yud Aleph. Hang on 1 second. Okay. Va'atalia eim Achazyahu ra'asa kimeis bina. Atalia, the mother of Achaziah, saw that her son Achaziah had died. So what did she do? Vatakam vate'abed es kol zera hamamlacha. She got up and destroyed, killed, all of the children in the monarchy. Meaning, all the potential heirs to the throne, she killed. Yoash is hidden from her and he survives, but she is going to hold the monarchy no matter what. So that what you're seeing here is a model which we associate in that medrash with Vashti in source number 6, right? Of women who themselves came from monarchy and took power for themselves. You follow? I'm going to show you now that you could add other women to this from Tanakh. So I'm going to call up the next pasuk here, which is Shmuel Bet Perek Vav Pasuk Chaf. This is when they brought the Aron to Yerushalayim. And David was dancing in front of the Aron. And Izebel, his wife Michal looks out the window and she's not so impressed. And then you get this pasuk that I highlighted for you. Vayashav David levareches beiso. David comes back to bless his household, give them gifts. Vateitzei Michal bas Shaul lekras David. Michal, daughter of Shaul. Right? Daughter of the king. We didn't need to mention that here. We know she's the daughter of the king. Nonetheless, we mention it because she comes out to greet David, Vatomer, and she says, Manichbad hayom melech Yisrael. Oh, how honored today is the king of Israel. Asher nigla hayom le'enei amhos avadav. He was revealed, exposed today before the eyes of the maids of his servants. Ki galos niglos achad harekim. Like one of the empty people, Michal asserts herself as the daughter of the king to rebuke David for his conduct. Now, David responds and says, you know, in the next pasuk, God chose me over your father. So, I guess, you know, that means I'm doing something right. But the point here is that you have another case in which the daughter of a king is expressing power independently, and in this case being critical of her husband. And I'll show you one other case involving the daughter of a king. Let's see. In Malachim Aleph, Perek Zion. Whoops, I went too far. Oh, I forgot. I used two keyboards because certain keys have stopped working on my main keyboard on the laptop. I must type too hard or something. Okay, there it is. So here we get, in Malachim Aleph, Perek Zion, Shlomo HaMelech builds a palace on behalf of the daughter of Paro, whom he marries. It's in Malachim Aleph, Perek Zion, the opening psukim here. In Pasuk Ches, Ubeiso asher yeshiv sham chatzera acheres mibeis la'ulam, kemaaseh hazeh haya, ubayis yaaseh levas Paro, asher lakach Shlomo ki'ulam hazeh. He builds a special dedicated palace for the daughter of the Pharaoh of Egypt, whom he has married. What I'm trying to show you with this is we have a history of women who are daughters of kings, who hold power and influence, and sometimes rebuke their husbands, sometimes kill out all the royal family subsequently. And so I think what the Medrash here is doing in the Gemara by saying Vashti is the daughter of a previous king, is it's saying, now I understand her refusal of Ahasuerus. That fits. She fits into this tipus. She fits into this mold. And once you have that, if you look at source number 9 on your sheet, once you have that, you can explain a whole lot of other stuff, including some of the points that Goldie made. So you take a look at source number 9. Well, that explains a lot. So first of all, it does explain the fact that we keep emphasizing, as Goldie noted, Hamalka. It also explains, taking Goldie's second point, the fact that she holds her party in Beit Hamalchut, in the royal palace. So you see that there as well. Goldie, I had actually just forgotten that I had that down there on the sheet. So you anticipated it. It also explains the fact that in Pasuk Yud Aleph, he says she should be brought out Beketer Malchut, in the royal crown. Not his crown, her crown. Because she has her own crown from her role as a member of her own royal family. Also, him not being from royal background explains certain things. For example, the text that said in the beginning of the Megillah, Hu Achashverosh HaMolech Mehodu V'yad Kush. Molech is a really funny verb. You could take it as he ruled. You could, and that's the way I think we usually read it. The Gemara in Megillah does a whole bunch of other things with the word Molech. But you could explain it to mean, HaMolech, he entered Malchut. He entered it, he wasn't born into it. It also explains how it is that Ahasuerus is able to break with Cyrus. Meaning, Cyrus helped the Jews. Ahasuerus is going to go with Haman's plot to harm the Jews, and even when Haman is defeated, he's still not willing to save them. There's more to say about that, obviously, but that's not for right now. It fits with a lot of things. It also fits with Haman as the Gemara presents Haman. The Gemara talks about Haman as also not coming from a great background. The power imbalance also explains certain other things about the story. I want to go back to Esther Perek Aleph. So I will share the screen again. There are some other things here that I think people often miss that are explained once you're willing to see Vashti as the royal in the family. Tell me something. How does Ahasuerus get her to the party, or try to get her to the party? What does he do?
He sends the lower servants to
He sends servants, right? Good. Well, not so good. But he sends seven servants to go bring Vashti. He doesn't order her himself. He orders the servants, go bring her. Right? And look what happens when she refuses. If you take a look at source at Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12. Vatma'ein ha-malka Vashti lavo bidvar ha-melech asher biyad ha-sarisim. Vashti refuses to come at the word of the king that is being brought by the sarisim. She refuses because it's beneath her. It's beneath her that the sarisim should come and order me to come to the party. Who are they? And it also explains the question I asked in the beginning of why he consults a political council about Vashti's refusal. Why is he consulting diplomats? And the answer is because he needs their support in order to be able to do anything to Vashti. Vashti is the true source of power, not him. Not only that, it also helps explain his marriage to Esther, right? Why in the world is he willing to marry somebody who has no pedigree, who brings nothing to the table in terms of political influence? Answer? Because he's fed up of being married to somebody with political power and influence. That didn't work out so well. Right? It's actually good that she doesn't say anything about where she comes from. That works in her favor to become queen, assuming that's a good thing for her to become queen, which is its own discussion. And I think it also answers one more question. When does Ahasuerus have Vashti brought to the party? What? Sorry?
On the seventh day?
On the seventh day of the second party. Right? First of all, I'll note for you, I asked the question earlier about why in the world he has her brought out at all. And I said, kings didn't treat their wives that way usually. The wife is private property. Look at the Maldim in source number 10. Okay, Hebrew on the bottom of one side, but I'll read the English at the top of the next. The Malbim asks the question here. He says, where is there a greater foolishness that a mighty king like this should bring his intimate bride to display her before the masses of the nations, the masses of the states, for she is beautiful? Right? Especially with the Medrash that we mentioned that he commanded she be brought unclothed. It is even more shocking how she was to be brought. It appears he commanded she be brought immediately against her will via the Sarisim as a degraded person would be brought. Such as she chose death rather than live with disgrace and humiliation. Right? Malbin picks up on it. He says, what a bizarre thing to ask. But I add to the bizarre character of it, because he did it in the second party, not the first party. He did it for the commoners. And he did it on the last day. What does it indicate to you, the fact that he waits until the last day of the second party? This goes back to the purpose of the party altogether. What does that indicate to you?
Is he trying to show, to the commoners and people, kind of trying to bring her down a peg?
Yeah. That's exactly what he wants to do, is to bring her down a peg. It goes back to our question about the goal of this party. Right? If the goal of this party is to say, I am great, I am independent, I am powerful, he wants to do that by bringing her down. And I think it's the last day of the second party because this is the apex of his party. The whole goal was to establish himself. This is his big moment. He's been maybe working up the guts to try it, right? But he needs to fulfill his plot of establishing himself as the great king. So everything he's done for the last 6 months and 7 days has been to reach this point. Okay, imagine that. For 6 months, he put up with all the different leaders of all the different places coming to his palace, drinking his wine, eating his food, right? All in order to achieve one end, which is to establish himself as the king over all. To establish himself as the true power. He's been thinking about this and planning this for a very long time. And she said no. She said no, and that's it. He's got nothing. All that work, all the influence, all everything that went into this, all the planning, is shot because she said no. Which...
But is he really shocked? Like, did he really assume that she would be okay with something like
that? I think he convinced himself of that, yeah.
It's kind of interesting because you see, on the it shows Vashti in a different light. Like, I was not aware of this persona, but it also, for me, shows Ahasuerus in a different light because he always sort of seems like a passive character who's, like, convinced of things by other people, needs everything sort of explained to him, and this gives him, like, a lot more agency.
Yes.
And for his own actions, which is, like, not a persona that I had.
Right. Well, that's what the Gemara does. When that, I mentioned the Gemara before about whether he's wise or foolish in plotting to bring the different groups at different times. The Gemara assumes he has agency. You're right that in much of the Megillah, he's being led around by other people, right? Haman, Esther, but this is his plan. That's the idea that I'm seeing here. So that explains why he's livid when she says no. Because the whole palace, the whole everything has just collapsed. My son Aaron asked me a question when I was talking through this idea with him when I was first looking at it. And so he said, so why does the Megillah omit the fact that Vashti is the true royal? Right? If Vashti is the true royal, why doesn't the Megillah say so? I think there's an answer. Well, he seems worried about it.
It's nice that your son recognizes that.
Mm-hmm.
But it never recognizes the...
Well, it does, though. With Izabel, we're told that she is the daughter of a king. With Atalia, we're told she's the daughter of Ahav.
Right, but Ahav was the king, and the story is about Ahav.
Uh-huh. Okay, I hear you. But I think the answer is because it's published in Persia. The Megillah is published in Persia. And Ahasuerus is still the king at the end of the Megillah. And it's probably not a good idea for you to publish a book that calls attention to the fact that his power came by marrying Vashti. There are other ideas like that within the Megillah that some suggest that's why the Megillah doesn't have Hashem's name in it. Like you're writing a book that the Persians are going to see. And that Ahasuerus is going to be aware of. You're probably better off downplaying the fact that Ahasuerus is not the source of power. That would be my answer.
That was right then and there. They wrote the book.
So
like
that's...
Ahasuerus saw the book about himself and his story.
So it's clear that he sees something. They send out an igeret. They have a scroll recording the story. Whether that's the same as the Book of Esther is actually unclear and needs more discussion. That's a very good question. But I have an important piece left, and I just looked at the clock and realized we have 2 minutes. And I want to at least express it, because it's fascinating. Why does Vashti refuse to come out? So, obviously, we now have an answer to that. But it's very interesting to note that the Gemara gives you one take on Vashti, and the Medrash and Esther Rabbah gives you a different take on Vashti. The Gemara in Megillah portrays Vashti as immoral. And she only refuses to go to the party because of what God does to her. She herself has no problem participating in this. She doesn't mind at all. I brought it for you in Source 11 and in Source 12. Source 11 asks the question that Goldie asked about the location of her party and suggests that she put it in the palace in order to enable immorality between the different guests. She wants her party to be right next to Ahasuerus' party. And it goes on to talk about in Source number 12 what Vashti did to the Jewish girls who worked for her. And it suggests that, is that just suggest, it says at the end of Source number 12, she would have been just fine coming out to the party, but she either got a tail or she broke out in Sara'at, right? Those are stories that you've heard, I trust. Why they say these things in particular is a good discussion for another time, but the point is that the Gemara says she is as immoral as Ahasuerus. She would have been very comfortable going out to that party. However, she refuses because God has put her in a position to be embarrassed. So in this version of it, she is a villain, and God is the one who brings her punishment. Contrast that with the Medrash in Esther Rabbah in source number 13, which says, no, she is a victim of Ahasuerus. She argued with Ahasuerus. If you look in the Medrash in source number 13, just look at my English translation quickly. She said to him, you know, if they see I'm attractive, they're going to kill you to get me. If they see that I'm ugly, you're going to be based. And, you know, you were my father's head of the stables, and now you've become king, and you're so corrupt, you're just like a stable boy still. She makes her arguments with him because she doesn't want to go. And Ahasuerus continues to insist. This fits more with the idea that she is a royal, and that she's refusing because she doesn't want to go. She's the power. She doesn't think Ahasuerus has the right to demand this of her. So I saw a fascinating idea, which I'm not necessarily convinced is correct. But nonetheless, I brought it for you because it's too fascinating not to. By Dr. Tamar Kadari in source number 14, Vashti Midrash and Agadah, she suggests that the Gemara reflects the attitude in Bavel to Vashti. Since Vashti is Babylonian, she becomes a model of the local Babylonian women. And so they are trying to portray her just like the women they know in Bavel, which is to say, they hate Jews, they would have abused Jews who were their servants, they were promiscuous, there's a level of immorality to them. And what it also does is act as a polemic. This is what the Babylonian women are like. So that's why the Babylonian sources will portray her in this negative light, says Dr. Kadari. Whereas the Israeli sources, they don't have any interest in doing that. I'm not convinced that Professor Kadari is right, because if you look further in the Medrash in Esther Rabbah, you find Midrashim there that also portray her as a Jew hater and also portray her as immoral. They talk about her wearing big day kahuna, the clothing of the Kohanim. They have all sorts of stuff there. I'm not convinced that one tradition is Babylonian and one tradition is Israeli. But what I think you do see is that there are two different schools of thought. In one school of thought, she's a villain, and in the other school of thought, she's a political victim. You follow? We could have spent more time on that and unpacked that fully, but at least we got the point there. So I gave you three review questions at the end. We had three different explanations for Ahasuerus's party, right? It was a power play, it was about the 70 years of the Jews, or it was about now I'm blanking on what my third one was. It was about God's feast and God manipulating everything. All of those were anchored in various places in the text, but it starts out in that we're told that it's year 3 when he sat on his throne. And that doesn't seem to jive. How did the sages determine that Vashti was a Babylonian royal? I think it's based on the model in Tanakh for women who come from royalty and end up being the dominant figure in the relationship. And it fits all these other aspects, textual and story, about her. Yes, Hadassah.
Sorry, you had mentioned before that Vashti was Belshazzar's daughter?
Yeah.
How do we know that?
So that's exactly what we're asking here. That's our question. How does the Gemara get that idea? And the argument that I'm making is the Gemara is doing it by seeing that we have a model elsewhere in Tanakh of women who are daughters of royalty who end up in a relationship with a king and become the dominant figure in it. That's what Isabel did. That's what Atalia did. That's what Michal Bat Shaul did. That's what Bat Paro did with Shlomo. They become very influential in the relationship, and they're coming from royalty themselves. And I showed you the Medrash, which specifically lumps together Vashti, with Izabel, and with Atalia, these women who had that same trait. So what the Gemara is doing when it says that she is Belshazzar's daughter is it's saying this fits a model that we know of women in Tanakh. And having said that, it also answers a lot of our questions. The questions that we had about the language in the text, about where she holds her party, about the power imbalance between her and Ahasuerus and why it's such a big deal for Ahasuerus that she come out to the party. You know, all of that fits once you understand that he married into royalty instead of being from royal stock himself. That's the idea. And then the last point, why did she refuse? Well, now it becomes very clear, right? You have two options. Either she refused because of what God did to her. She's immoral, but that would, you know, but she couldn't because of the tail and the tzara'at. Or because she is a political victim and she doesn't want to come out. She does not want to be reduced in her power. And that's why she refuses to join the party. Clear? Hopefully? All right. Well, thank you very much. Then next week we get to talk about Haman's lottery. And as I said in the beginning, Refuah Shlema for David Zev ben Sittel. Okay. And Chodesh Tov. We got Adar starting tonight.